Welcome. My name is Gilad Berenstein, and thank you for joining us for another episode of the AI and Faith podcast. On this podcast, we're bringing together experts from our community and thought leaders from around the world so that together we can learn the key lessons required to build a world where AI benefits humanity and all of us individually.
What it means to be a religious institution today means to be responding much, much more quickly to a world that is changing rapidly. You can't expect that this generation is basically going to look like the generation before and the generation after. And that requires entirely new kinds of leadership, requires new training mechanisms, and requires listening to people and the things that they want and the way that they're responding to technologies. Because often it is not religious leaders who are the ones who are first to encounter new technologies, it's their congregants. So all of those need to be revolutionized.
Welcome and Happy New Year. First and foremost, to all of us at AI and Faith, we want to wish you a Happy New Year and hope you had a wonderful holiday season. Over the past few years, we have focused on a large variety of topics and aspects of artificial intelligence and the way it is coming into our world. Today, as we kick off a new year, we are excited to bring you a conversation about how good things can get with AI, what we are calling lessons from faith for a future of AI abundance. So let's get started. Thank you both for joining us today. It is really wonderful to have you, especially as we start a new year together. So to kick things off, please tell us a bit about yourself and what you do, and DZ will have you kick us off.
My name is DZ Kalman. I'm a research fellow at the Shalom Hermann Institute and a senior advisor at Sinai and Synapses. I do a lot of work around religion and technology, kind of unusually coming out of a background as a historian. I spent a lot of time thinking about the relationship between Jewish history and the history of technology in particular. But because of AI and how pressing it is to think about this and develop solutions and societal frameworks for this emerging technology, I've also started to think broadly about, you know, how do different faith perspectives engage with AI? What does that look like? So that's where I'm here.
That is awesome. And Brian?
Hi, I'm Brian Sigman. I'm the CEO and publisher of Friendship Press. We are an ecumenical Christian publisher affiliated with the National Council of Churches in the United States. My background is more coming from biblical studies, but with a heavy dose of science fiction and popular science mixed in that several years ago got me really interested in all these questions about how faith can help us grapple with the implications of technology and the ways that it's changing our world. And so I've been very privileged to be part of AI and Faith for several years now, and also to kind of help address some of these questions through our publishing efforts at Friendship Press.
That is awesome. And we're so fortunate to have both of you joining us today. Now, before we jump fully into AI abundance, when we were getting to know each other, Brian, you mentioned a concept that you called faith for a better future. Tell us a tiny bit more about that.
Yeah, that's actually our slogan at Friendship Press. Our vision, I guess, is Christian resources that create a better future for all. But the way we talk about that is to say faith for a better future. And there's really a couple of elements of that. One is celebrating stories of the ways we have seen God working in the world and saying, this is what God is doing. Let's see if we can get on board with that. And so we try to focus on that storytelling. Another thing we want to try to do is we want to try to advocate for justice with our publishing, to say faith for a better future for all, not just for a limited group of people. But then beyond that, it's about asking questions about what faith looks like in a changing world and making sure we are getting that right. Because I think we all know how bad it can get if we get it wrong. But if we ask, what if we get it right? What are the great implications of that? And then finally, how do we mine the resources of our faith? I think as AI and Faith puts it, the wisdom of the world's religious traditions. How do we mine those resources to help us in that endeavor? And so we're really also looking back to Christian scripture to say, this is what we see within our own faith tradition that can help. And we want to bring that and make that part of the conversation. So that's what we're trying to do at Friendship Press. And I found that faith for a better future is a really quick and concise and compelling way to talk about that.
Absolutely. And of course, we love that vision and why you're such a perfect guest to join us today. And DZ, before we jump in, I'm hoping you could tell us a little bit more about your work with Judaism and tech and what that work is all about.
Sure. I would say that Judaism and the Jewish community broadly are a little bit late to the game thinking about artificial intelligence. ChatGPT launched, and shortly thereafter, the war in Gaza started. And regardless of where you are on the political spectrum, that war has taken up a lot of both emotional and also intellectual energy, which might have otherwise gone to thinking about AI. So I felt this like really, really concretely because people ask me all the time, like, you know, come talk to us about this subject or not. And when the war started, interest in AI dropped off a cliff. So it's coming back a little bit now, but it's slow. So some of the work that I'm doing is putting together all the various folks, both who work as Jewish leaders and also who work in the tech industry, to think together about what does it mean to develop a Jewish response. I come from the position that there is no Jewish response to be unearthed from the past. There is no such thing as ancient wisdom, which can automatically, without any interpretation, be applied to AI. It's simply too complicated and too far removed from the past for that. But that doesn't mean you can't apply anything at all. And it still means the past has some value. So a lot of the work that I'm doing is developing that response right now.
That is awesome. That is really wonderful work you both are doing in the world. And we're so grateful to have you as a part of our community. Now, before we talk about AI abundance, I'm hoping to spend a minute or two just talking about abundance in general. And looking back at your faith traditions and at history, I'm hoping you can give us a view into how you think about abundance and how you think about living the good life. And of course, anything that your faith teaches you on that front. And Brian, maybe you kick us off.
Yeah, sure. I was thinking about this the other day, and I can't remember if this was a quote that I heard somewhere or if I just sort of made it up or as an amalgamation. The way I keep coming back to it is abundance. One way to think about it is our resources are so prolific, so profound, we can effectively have whatever we want. Yeah. And the way I think about that from my own faith tradition is to say, when you can have whatever you want, it becomes really important to want the right thing, right? Because every choice we make limits our further choices. Every choice we make sends us down a path. So when we're no longer limited by what's available, that elevates the importance of our own choice. And so as I think about my own tradition, I think about, okay, what are those resources that help me want the right things? As philosophers say it sometimes, to want what I want to want, right? Yeah. And not have those desires be bound up by whatever it is inside me that's unhealthy and things like that. So there's a liberation of myself that has to be a part of that abundance. And that's really where my mind goes first as I think about it.
I love that. Liberation of oneself. That's a beautiful concept. And DZ, what does Judaism teach us about abundance?
So it's interesting. You know, I have been learning the beginning of Genesis with my daughter. And we got to the part of the story of Adam and Eve and the fruit in the garden where Adam is cursed. And his curse involves having to work the land and that being difficult, that requiring toil. And my daughter correctly pointed out, that's actually not that hard anymore, right? The amount of time that she or I spends, you know, harvesting crops, or even the amount of physical labor it takes to, you know, bake a cake is relatively small compared to what it was even 100, 200 years ago. Yeah. I think we are still grappling with the implications of that, whether that's good, I think it is good, but where that energy gets displaced to. Yeah. But I think there's kind of a broader question of what are the theological implications of that movement? There is a guide that was put out by the Orthodox Union, which kind of it does a lot of kosher supervision around the country. They have put out a guide for bakeries. And one of the things they say in the introduction to the guide, and this is like the last place you would expect to find something theologically interesting, is they said something to the effect of, maybe we are coming closer to the Messianic age because now making bread is a lot easier than it is described in the beginning of Genesis. So there is something there. There is something there that I think is kind of difficult to grasp. And it gets to this problem of, like, you have these religious traditions which have a way of thinking about the future where Messianic era means, like, and everything becomes better and everything is perfect. And in a lot of ways, we have achieved what those visions require. And the religious traditions don't necessarily have the language to think about that achievement and what comes after that. And I think there's a kind of struggle that comes because of that.
That was awesome. I can't wait to dig into that in another minute. Now, I want to bring AI abundance directly into our conversation. And when I speak to my friends down in Silicon Valley who are, you know, kind of leading the AI abundance movement, they describe a possible future that feels like the height of the Roman Empire, a time where it makes sense for citizens to be poets, philosophers, artists, etc., because productivity was taken care of for them. They didn't have to worry about food or energy or construction. And of course, the Romans did this in this very unethical way by having slaves and subjugation all over the world. But of course, the AI accelerationists believe that we can find highly ethical ways to increase productivity and to lift the standard of living. And they talk about the fact that maybe soon we will tell our kids that it makes sense for them to become poets or sculptors or something like that again. And when I talk to other friends who are maybe a little bit closer to Earth, but still very much believe in this vision of AI abundance, they talk about a world free of disease,
of the fact that we can use this technology to cure the cancers and these diseases that have been plaguing us for so many generations and have a world where many of us get to live happier, healthier lives for longer. And people talk about having more time for things like family and friendship and faith and fun. And of course, even for those of us who still work, which I do think will be most of us in the future, we can imagine jobs that are much more meaningful, that are centered around human connection, human creativity and art, as opposed to some of the tasks we do now, which of course is the future I'm very excited about. So starting with you, Brian, how do you think about AI abundance? And of course, any elements from your faith that may help us think about this future?
You know, I think for me, I would probably tend to fall somewhere between the second and third visions that you articulated. And there's a couple of reasons for that. Number one, I think my mind goes first to problem solving, right? What are the big problems that humankind is trying to solve right now that are sort of obstacles to our flourishing as individuals, maybe as a species? You know, so I think of climate change. I think of human health, hunger, things like that. What can AI offer to help us sort of move past some of those obstacles and achieve a life that's more abundant for all? I think AI really does offer some great opportunities to do that, because so much of those problems are really big. They're really complex. An individual or even a group of individuals, we might be limited, but AI can really add some processing power to those kinds of things, help us envision possibilities that maybe we haven't seen. Help us model the implications of some of that and see how it will play out without having to go too far into implementation before we know if a scenario is likely to work or not. I also go to the advancement of human knowledge, right? So research, things like space exploration, things like biology, things like that AI can really help us with. I also tend to agree with you that we are likely to continue to labor. And part of that is informed by my faith tradition, where labor for humans is actually an important part of who we are. The word labor kind of has a negative connotation, but to do things that are meaningful, that are creative, that bump us up against our environment, create feedback loops for us to respond to, all that is a really important part of who we are. It's how we find fulfillment in the world. And I don't think anybody would really want to desire to for that to go away. And I think we'll find ways of expressing ourselves in those ways in the future, even if it's really, really abundant, whatever that might mean.
Yeah, absolutely. I was having a conversation similar to this with a Catholic friend of mine, and she was mentioning that one of the main ways that they think of God is as a creator. And the idea that if we are made in the image of God, then actually creation and toiling and labor is actually a core part of who we are, which
absolutely
really is at my core. That I always say in the business setting, a job, as we all know, is about a lot more than money. And anyways, I totally agree. Now, bringing DZ back into the conversation, how do you think about abundance and how good could things get?
So I find myself caught between two ideas. One is, you know, I was inspired as a kid by Carl Sagan, as or so many people. And one of the things he says, and I'm going to quote him, but I'm not going to do the voice. He says, "It will not be we who reach Alpha Centauri and the other nearby stars. It will be a species very like us, but with more of our strengths and fewer of our weaknesses, more confident, far-seeing, capable, and prudent." And I think there's this idea that going along with humanity really revolutionizing itself over and over again, expanding out into other planetary systems, humanity necessarily will change in fundamental ways. And some of that's good, right? You know, I think it's hard to make an argument with a straight face that the human body as currently conceived is perfect in all ways. There's all sorts of ways in which, you know, evolution kind of like drops our bodies off like a bus that kind of comes short of its actual stop, you know, after we've reached reproductive, you know, we finish like the age we're supposed to be having progeny. And there's lots of ways that we can improve on that. I'm sympathetic to the idea that along with artificial intelligence is this notion of a humanity that is fundamentally different, and that transhumanism really goes part and parcel with AI. And at the same time, you know, I grew up in Canada. There's a band in Canada called the Arrogant Worms. And they have an anti-war song, which has this line that sticks in my head. "We want to play hockey, have kids, and grow old." And like, that's it. Like, at the end of the day, that's kind of what people want. They want to have lives which are relatively free of pain and suffering. They want to find meaning in the things that they do, both recreational and also labor. And they want to have long lives. And asking people to change because it happens to be that the technology you're developing would be more in demand if people were different seems backwards. And maybe that the human desires are actually relatively limited. And if they're limited, then to kind of create artificial demand on the basis of a technology you're creating is incredibly dangerous. In fact, there is a word for that, which is addicting people, right? Addicting people to technologies because it happens to be useful for you is a trend in human history that has been going on for a very long time, right? You see it in the opium wars, you see it in the development of cigarettes, you see it in all kinds of modern technologies, which are designed around contemporary understandings of how to make humans want more things. That is incredibly destructive. So I think there's a kind of balance, and I hate saying this because I hate saying like, well, there needs to be a kind of balance, but there does need to be a kind of balance here between, on the one hand, understanding that humanity as a whole is going to change, and the other hand, not treating humanity as it currently exists and its relatively limited wants as being problematic in some way, and actually treating that with a great deal of respect. And I think part of what it means to approach artificial intelligence from a religious perspective is to respect humanity as it currently exists and not just say, well, humanity itself ought to be different because the technology I'm developing wants it to be different.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it makes me think of this very small example. You may remember a while ago, one of the co-founders of OpenAI created a guide to how to create a prompt that's most effective in OpenAI. And I remember people like, this is so cool. And I had the opposite reaction. What you're telling me is that I should be morphing my communication as a human to the way AI wants to communicate. And of course, the whole promise of AI is the exact opposite of that. Yep. It's AI morphing itself to fit us. Brian, please join us in this point.
I was thinking about the song lyric you quoted about we want to, I'll probably get it wrong, but play hockey, have kids, and grow old, right? I focused in on the play hockey part of that. There's an element of competition in that, right? Like a hockey match or any kind of competition, there's struggle that's part of that. There's going to be a winner and loser. There's going to be a striving and all of that. I think that that's an important piece to call out because humans are wired for some sort of competition, struggle, whether it's against each other, whether it's our environment. And that actually fuels our development. That actually fuels our creativity, our art. I think art in a world totally of abundance would actually be kind of boring. Because so much good art is a reflection on human struggle and human striving and bumping up against our limitations and overcoming those limitations, finding ways to do that. So I'm actually energized by a world where those limitations change, but don't go away.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think your point you made about art is a point that I often make about cuisine. If we think about cuisine, it is almost always poor people food that they had to take whatever ingredients were around them. And they had to make them edible and desirable and delicious in some fashion. There's a number of books that have been written about why America doesn't have American cuisine. And of course, our friends in New Orleans would disagree. And I agree with them that Creole and Cajun cuisine is a uniquely American cuisine. But part of the answer to the question is that that America was born in abundance, or the Western, you know, the European, you know, colonization of America was at a time of abundance. And the whole joke is, if you could have filet mignon every night for dinner, why would you develop cuisine? You could just have these amazing raw ingredients. But anyways, I'm belaboring the point a little bit, but I totally agree with what you said, which is when we look at art, at food, at human creation of different kinds, we see a human experience, a human narrative within that, which is really meaningful to us. And, you know, one way that I often ask this question is, when we have a robot NBA league, will anyone want to go watch them play? And of course, the first time, yes, we're all going to want to see the novelty of robots trying to play basketball. But after you've seen it two or three times, is it really the human exceptionalism, which is what we like about the NBA or the NFL or whatever, in which case the robots probably will not demonstrate human exceptionalism, but, you know, lots to unpack in there. Now, I want to bring the point of productivity back into the center of the conversation. You know, one thing that most people agree with is that AI will increase productivity. Businesses will do more, will produce more in the same amount of time, in the same unit of effort. And I'm wondering how you guys, based on your philosophical traditions and faith traditions, think about the spreading of this productivity. You know, assuming we are right and we increase our productivity, what can we learn? Like, how do we make sure that that productivity increase supports humanity as opposed to a very small number of humans? And you want to add on those, DZ, to start.
So there's a disconnect between the way that this conversation happens among the folks who are developing the technology and basically everyone else. You know, a couple of years ago, Marc Andreessen published his tech manifesto. And one of the things that was so striking in it was this idea that kind of like morality is an exercise left to the reader. That like we'll develop the technology and then like it's somewhere else in the ecosystem, we'll figure out like how to make sure that it is ethical and safe and all the rest. I think something similar happens in thinking about like how do these new powerful tools end up kind of translating into useful tools in society. And the problem is that there is not enough communication and exchange between tech development and social institutions, between government institutions, between religious institutions. None of those other bodies are set up to work at the pace that tech is moving. And tech does not seem particularly interested in slowing down to make sure that those institutions can catch up. So part of this is a kind of like callous disregard of that speed differential. So that itself is a problem. On the other hand, I don't know that the other institutions in our lives that have more of a role to play in thinking about how to translate their productivity into useful gains for human welfare, I don't know that they have fully grasped that this is actually on them too. What it means to be a religious institution today means to be responding much, much more quickly to a world that is changing rapidly. You can't expect that this generation is basically going to look like the generation before and the generation after. And that requires entirely new kinds of leadership, requires new training mechanisms, and requires listening to people and the things that they want and the way that they're responding to technologies. Because often it is not religious leaders who are the ones who are first to encounter new technologies. It's their congregants. So all of those need to be revolutionized. There is not an easy way to do that. It is going to be a messy process. Part of what is needed is a recognition that the speed itself is a bit of a problem, that working as fast as you possibly can isn't always the best way to proceed. But part of it's recognition that you can't just engage with technology by saying like, well, are they going to accept or reject the things that you're giving to us? It requires a kind of like cooperation and a partnership, creativity on the other side. But that takes more work. And I think we're still a ways away from seeing those other institutions really step up.
Absolutely. And Brian, how do you see this?
The pace of change question is really interesting. As you were articulating that, I was like, yeah, what can faith traditions do to increase the pace of response to try to keep up or to try to respond in something that approximates real time to these developments? And one thing that struck out to me, and this there's some of this in sort of contemporary Christian theological formation, is an idea of improvisation, right? To be able to be formed, to be shaped spiritually in such a way that you are able to improvise in a moment when something happens and you've got to make a spur of the moment decision. You're going to make an ethical decision, not because you have time to really think through it, but because you've been formed in such a way that integrity, that character, that doing the right thing is a place where you naturally try to go. And even if you get it a little bit wrong, you're at least coming from a good place in doing that. And you're more likely to get it right because of the formation that's been a part of your background. And so I actually think one part of the solution is training children, training adults in faith formation and whatever that looks like to really shape your character first off, and then begin to gesture at how that might be applied in different circumstances that really can't be anticipated. We're not going to be able to anticipate every change that's on the horizon. So what can we do to prepare ourselves to respond faithfully when those unexpected things come about?
Now, I want to turn our conversation a little bit to personal use cases of AI and what we can learn, you know, and I often say that when I think about my fears with AI, I rarely think about Terminator and the AI that hates us and wants to kill us all or something like that. And I often think about WALL-E, the AI that becomes so good at doing so many things that we humans voluntarily give up our agency. You know, like in the movie WALL-E, you know, we become these kind of video game addicts and floating chairs. So AI is bringing a lot of new capabilities into our world. And I'm wondering from your experience, from your own faith and perspectives, are there any lessons we could learn about more pro-human, pro-society use cases maybe, or any pitfalls that you can imagine that we might want to try to avoid as we bring these new capabilities and new technologies into our world? And maybe Brian will put you in the hot seat first this time.
Yeah, sounds good. Yeah, the WALL-E question, I think that's the one that scares me the most as well. And it's because we're actually, in that scenario, we are subjugated at a level that's more intimate than an overt subjugation. It's not just our bodies, it's our very will, it's our desires that are bound up in that scenario. So we don't even want the right thing in a scenario like that. So for me, in the Christian tradition, there's this idea of liberating our desires, liberating our heart,
yeah,
so that we're able to want the right thing. There's an element of healing that comes from God that can set us free and enable us to then participate constructively in our, in the Christian tradition, we would say salvation, but participate constructively in the renewal of the world. But there's this healing that has to take place. So that's one place I would go to, is what sort of healing needs to happen within us as a society applying it to AI, we might talk about algorithmic bias. Where does that healing need to happen? And then once that healing has happened, then algorithms that are set free of bias can become constructive partners in our pursuit of abundance, pursuit of a world. So that's the place I go first in that scenario, is to say, where are our biases? What healing needs to happen? And then what becomes possible when when those biases are removed?
I love the idea of using AI to heal our wounds as opposed to be a band-aid or a crutch that we rely on. I think that's very powerful.
Just a quick clarification. I'm not sure AI can heal our wounds, but AI can become an active participant alongside us in the healing of our wounds. So that's a, I'm an editor, so I can't help editing a little bit.
No, an important distinction. Absolutely. And DZ, how do you think about this?
The Wall-E example is so interesting because in some ways we already are those helpless humans from Wall-E, right? If you dropped me into society 1,000 years ago, 1,500 years ago, I would be pretty helpless. I think most of us would be, right? Like we are constantly like adjusting the places that we spend energy, the muscles that we build up, physical and mental, in response to our environments. And I think that makes a lot of sense. Where I do worry and where I do think the analogy makes sense is in thinking about the loss of agency. A lot of the technologies that we have built up, especially around the last 10, 20 years, are designed to remove our agency because agency is unpleasant sometimes. It's not fun to make lots of choices. I remember becoming a parent for the first time and realizing that, a lot of being a parent is just an endless sea of choices that you have to make and the exhaustion of the choices themselves. And there is, there's an idea, a term, I think I heard in a YouTube video called algorithmic complacency, which I find very useful. The idea that human beings would often prefer to defer decisions to some algorithm rather than needing to make them themselves. And a lot of the technologies we have are designed around that idea that like we would rather pass off the decision to someone else. So I think insisting that we preserve our agency, that agency is a value in and of itself, is something we need to do. You ask like, what does this mean from a faith tradition? And part of the problem here, like the recurring problem, is that there is not really a religious tradition that's going to tell you like we have a clear idea of agency within us. Maybe there's an idea of like, don't give yourself over to the devil, or maybe there's an idea that like, human free will is unique in some way, right? So like those ideas do exist, but it's a little bit different from the idea of agency in and of itself. That actually needs to be newly articulated. And I don't know that any religious tradition is in a better position to do that than any other. In fact, I see a lot of religious traditions trying to do kind of like similar things, working within their own institutional frameworks to develop these ideas at the same time. But that one seems pretty important.
Absolutely. Now, one more question on this theme before we switch a little bit and speak a little bit more about theology is connection between humans and AI. And I was going to ask this question either way, but I was reading the news this morning and I saw a story about a woman in Japan who just went through a wedding ceremony and married her AI companion. And I'll be honest, I found that uncomfortable and certainly did not seem to me like the best idea. I'm trying to approach this with as little judgment as I possibly can, but I want to make the other point on the other side that she hadn't found a partner in life and that she was lonely. So how do you guys think about the relationship between humans and AI, and are there positive relationships you can imagine, or should we really be thinking about it more like a tool? And maybe DZ, we can have you start.
Yeah, I think there's a couple ways of thinking about the problem there, if we agree it's a problem. One way to think about it is that it's a problem because it doesn't work, right? Like there's an illusion that this is a serious relationship when in fact it is missing something vital, which all human relationships require, like some other flesh and blood body in the mix. Maybe that's a way to think about it. The other way to think about it is that it's a problem because it does work. It's a problem because actually it is providing you with all the things that you might want in a package that maybe looks a little bit different. I think that one is closer to the truth in that it actually does provoke all the, a lot of the feelings that people have towards actual human beings. Like if people feel love, like that is love, right? It's who are we to second guess the love that a person feels towards an AI in the same way that like, who are we to second guess the love that people feel in other contexts, right? Now, is that healthy on a society level? No, I don't think it is. Here again, I think an analogy to addiction and to drugs is helpful. The pleasant feelings that you experience when you take some substance could be great. Like they're authentic in some way. But the question is like, if you play that out on a societal level, if you play that out over many, many interactions, Does that continue to work? And I don't know that it does. So I think the issue here is, for all the ways in which AI can stimulate us, and there's a million ways that AI can stimulate us, how do we make sure that we do not end up in a society which basically human beings stop seeing the value in interacting with each other?
And Brian, I want to bring you into this and also ask the question of, is this a little bit like idol worship, like when you have a relationship with this, or is that far too extreme of a way of putting it?
It might be too extreme. I think too, when you have a relationship with another person, there is a way in which that other person is given to you, right?
Yeah.
And what I mean by that is not any time of ownership, but they are other than you. You have very little control over who they are, over the choices they make. And there's an element of vulnerability in that connection there. And that exists on both parts. They're having to risk something to have a relationship with you, and you're having to risk something to have a relationship with them. I think a lot of that vulnerability goes away when we have an AI that's a part of that, because AI in a lot of ways, at least the type of AI we're talking about, generative AI, sort of reflects back to us who we are, what we want, what we're looking for.
Yeah.
And that otherness, even though it's really other because it's not even a human, but in terms of the way it interacts with you, that otherness is gone and it demands a little bit less of you, maybe a lot less of you. And what it calls forth from you is going to be different as well. We really can't predict. Say we have a marriage with another person. When we say yes to that marriage, when we commit ourselves to that person, we don't really know everything we're committing to. We're committing to 20 years from now. We don't know what that's going to look like. And some of that uncertainty is gone when we talk about a relationship with an AI. So I didn't really answer your question about idolatry there. Because for me, mentally, I put idolatry into a different category, which is worship and not relationship, right?
Yeah.
I also think if there's a person in our society for whom an AI is the right relationship, I wonder, maybe it's because we have failed them in some way. Maybe other humans aren't giving to that person what it is that they need. And that's on us, right? That's on our society to say,
absolutely,
there are people among us who aren't getting the fulfillment they require from other humans and have to turn to AI as a result of that. And I want to say that as judgment-free as possible, but to say, you know, sometimes it's a reflection on everybody else who might be falling short when an AI is an effective and desirable substitute for human connection.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's actually a topic we've touched on the podcast earlier this year, the concept of loneliness and the fact that ultimately, I imagine we all agree that the best cure to loneliness is connection with other humans. But having these really difficult questions about, there are people from whom, unfortunately, there's not a lot of family and friends who are able to be a part of that. And what's the right solution there? And of course, these are really difficult questions for us to think about. But I really want to just spend one more second kind of meditating on the point you made, which is so relevant to my view on this question, which is, I always say, when you're engaging with another human, we're both making a decision to be in this engagement, even if it's just a short conversation you're having with another human. And I always joke when I talk about this in the business setting, like we all could have pretended to have a work emergency and left this lunch or left this conversation, whatever. But all of us with our own agency have chosen to participate. And there is something really special about the fact that I know that the two of you have chosen to spend this time with me right now and with our AI and faith community. And of course, even if we had an AI that was just as engaging as any of us, that AI would not have made that choice in the same way a human does. And I think there's something fundamentally different about that, which is, of course, why I'm such a believer in the power of human connection and human relationship. Now, before we run out of time, you're both engaged in this really awesome work of trying to bring your faith and your communities kind of into this world, into the future as AI comes. So for kind of our last question before we conclude here, I'm hoping you each can give some advice to, you know, members of your faith, members of other faiths, organizations, you know, faith organizations. How can they join us on this journey of trying to bring technology into the world in a way that benefits all of us, and any kind of lessons that you can share from your own work? And Brian, I'll have you kick us off.
Sure. I would think one piece of advice I would give, and it's a little bit from my own experience, is to sort of expect the unexpected, right? You don't know where solutions, for lack of a better term, where good resources for theological reflection are going to come from. I was looking through the Bible a couple of weeks ago, trying to think through, okay, what is in here about AI? And I happened to be in some of the laws in Exodus that talked about what to do if an ox gores another person and who's responsible for that. I thought, you know, that's one that I have always just skipped right over because I don't own any oxen. And we've got different laws to deal with those situations now. And I've just thought, okay, that's for a past time, that's irrelevant. But actually, if you think about if there's a piece of property that injures another person that you are responsible for, where does the responsibility lie? Is it with only the ox, or is it with the person who owns the ox, and under what conditions? Well, that actually does have an application to AI when we've creating these machines that have some kind of agency of their own and can act a little bit independent of human condition. So this piece of scripture that for me, I've been like, oh, that's just, I don't know what to do with that. It's just a relic. Now all of a sudden it's actually maybe pretty useful to help us think through the implications of AI. For me, that was a real learning moment to say, to try to predetermine where I'm going to look for help within my own tradition. I really limit myself. So look everywhere, be curious, look everywhere, and be open to a surprise, I guess.
I love that. And that is such a good example of why AI and faith exist in the first place, because there is so much wisdom that we can take from the past and apply to the future. I love that. And what about you, DZ?
Yeah, let me start with that example because I've seen exactly those texts get used within Jewish context to make claims around things like self-driving cars, right? Which kind of seems similar to oxen in terms of ownership and kind of like semi-autonomy and that stuff. I am very nervous about using the text on their own. And the reason I'm nervous is that there is a strong incentive to use texts like that as a substitute to personal charismatic authority, right? Don't look at me, spiritual leader of the present day. Look at the text that I am citing from 2000 years ago, because that text has more authority than I do. And so it's a way to kind of like get out of needing to make a claim on your own or use your own political capital. And I don't think that works. I think the texts are too complicated. I think like there's no way to translate from a verse in the Bible directly to some piece of code in an AI system without so much interpretation along the way that like the interpretation is most of it. So I think that there's a need to be honest within traditions about like the limits of what the text can tell you. And that actually means that the theologians of those traditions matter more because they actually need to be thinking through like what actually can we say and what can we not say and like where do we need assistance and like where does policy fit in? So that matters quite a bit. And the other thing that I would say that religious traditions really need to be focusing on right now is listening to their own people. One of the things that technology does is it radically disempowers almost everyone. It makes everyone feel like I'm just going to have to accept the technology that comes into my life because if I don't, then I am excluding myself from the 21st century economy and I don't want to do that. So, I'm going to say yes to the phones. I'm going to say yes to the AI. I'm going to say yes to the virtual reality. Like, I'm going to say yes to all of it, right? Even if we aren't happy about it, out of a sense of like it's inevitable. I heard a phrase yesterday of manufactured inevitability, which I think is useful here. It's not all inevitable, some of it is. But I think one of the things that religious traditions can do, especially religious communities, as some of the surviving organizations that sit between the family and the state, is help people actually activate their own perceptions of reality and their sense of what is right and wrong as not just being kind of like incidental and something to be shoved away because it's inconvenient. But actually something that they should pick up and think about and voice. I don't know that people have the most well-formed thoughts about all the ways that they want to see AI in the world and don't want to see AI in the world. It actually takes someone saying like, no, your opinion on this actually does matter for that to happen. And right now that has not really happened. So I think there's a role in religious communities, not just saying like, we already know the answer, but actually seeking the answer from the community from a ground up perspective as well.
Absolutely. And I just want to say that my reflection is I am just so grateful to have both of you in our community and to have both of you helping us think about these thoughts. At the end of the day, AI is coming and it is going to change our world. Even though I completely agree with the point about very few things are inevitable, but I'm just so grateful to have you guys thinking about these things. Now, before I let you go, we do have a lightning round, 15 seconds apiece, three questions, and Brian to go first. So my first question is, what's your favorite holiday tradition?
Oh man, well, it's probably Christmas, and we go visit a botanical garden that has beautiful lights, millions of lights, and we do that every year with my family.
That's outstanding. And DZ?
I love Passover. It's great.
Passover is my favorite Jewish holiday. And I always say I love Thanksgiving because it feels like the American Passover, at least the closest thing we have. So that definitely resonates. Okay,
As a
DZ, let
Canadian who adopted Thanksgiving later in my life, I completely agree.
me. Yeah, amazing. Well, you're going to go first in this next one. What's one thing you're incredibly proud of yourself for in 2025?
I'm happy with the work that I've put out about AI this year. There's a lot of movement happening right now and a lot of connecting doing so. I'm just glad to be part of this, riding the wave. I'll say, like, I'm really proud of my podcast, Belief in the Future, about religion and technology, which, you know, there's a new season starting up in a few months. And I think there's a lot of people who listen to the show will be interested in that one as well.
Absolutely. And Brian?
You know, we're doing a lot of really exciting things at Friendship Press, and I think I've taken the lead on a lot of those things, developing our vision and articulating that and getting a lot of people on board with that vision. And yeah. So I'm really proud of where we're going as an organization and how I've been a part of that.
Amazing. And then last question, Brian, do you typically make it to midnight on New Year's Eve?
No.
And DZ?
Yeah, I do. But I make it to midnight on most nights.
Yeah, there you go. Well, ever since I had toddlers, I also do not make it to midnight. Thank you both so much for joining us. I hope you have a happy new year. And of course, thank you to everyone in the AI and Faith community for continuing to engage with us on these important conversations. Have a happy new year to all of you.
Stay tuned to listen to more conversations and interviews with experts from around the world. In the meantime, follow and rate our podcast on your favorite podcast platform and share it with your friends so they can join this important conversation. Don't forget to also follow us on social media. We are on LinkedIn, X, and Blue Sky. Thank you for joining us.